Thank you, Mr. Haney. Welcome to everyone who is here. Happy Sabbath. I know that there are some who are out sick, and hopefully that won't be for too long. It's that time of year where sickness seems to go around quite a bit. So welcome everyone here and on the webcast. I think we all agree that faith is foundational to being a Christian. Faith is foundational to being a Christian. I'd like to begin the message today by reviewing faith and faithfulness, what they mean, how they're similar, how they're different. I think it's pretty obvious that they're related to each other. You know, the word faith is within faithfulness. But a review of how they are related, both by definition and in real life application, can be helpful. So here are some basic facts and definitions. There are 5 Hebrew and 4 Greek words in Scripture related to faith. The most common translations in the King James Version of these 9 words are faith, faithful, faithfulness, hope, believe, trust, and truth. These are the most common ways that these words are translated. And all of them can be boiled down to 2 basic definitions. The belief or conviction that something is true, what we know as faith, the belief or conviction that something is true. And second, someone who can be relied on, someone who is worthy of trust. Faithful. And what's interesting is that 6 of these 9 words, they're translated both ways, you know, where each of these 2 definitions can apply. You know, sometimes as faith, the belief or conviction something is true, and sometimes the same word is translated as faithful or faithfulness or something along those lines. Someone that can be relied on, someone that is worthy of trust. Another interesting fact is that the word faith is found over 200 times in the New Testament, but only twice in the Old Testament. Whereas the Old Testament uses the word faithful or faithfulness much more often, at 55 times. What's my point? Well, the point is that by studying some of these definitions, some of these translations of faith and faithful, it helps to show us or confirm that they are inseparable. It's not like, you know, some distant relative we have who we share the same name, but we don't really know each other that well. No, these are very much connected. They're bonded and cannot be separated. Let's turn to James chapter 2. James chapter 2. The section here about faith without works is dead. We're going to read just verse 18. Verse 18 of James chapter 2. James 2, verse 18. It says, "But someone will say, 'You have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works.'" You cannot have faith without being faithful, you know, the works, the actions we have, and you can't be faithful without having faith. We all have faith. We have faith in God. Like Abraham, we are fully convinced that what God has promised, he is able to perform. We have faith in God. Why do we have faith in God? Well, he is faithful. He is perfectly faithful. He's proven that. We can read in a scripture we've experienced in our own lives, God is faithful, and that's where our faith begins. Our faith begins with God's faithfulness. That's why we have faith, why we trust in him, because we know that he is faithful. But then we, in turn, show our faith in God by what we do, by being faithful to him. So faith, true godly faith, is really sandwiched between faithfulness. God's faithfulness, and our faithfulness. So we mentioned earlier how faith is foundational to being a Christian, but when we think about it all this way, lost my place here for a minute, excuse me. When we think about it this way, our faith is based, or its foundation is based on God's faithfulness. They're very much connected, faith and faithfulness. Let's turn next to Luke chapter 16 and get to the main topic for the message today. Luke chapter 16. This is the parable of the unjust steward, and there are so many lessons from this parable. We're going to read verse 10. A memory verse in many ways, Luke chapter 16 and verse 10. The master says, or Christ teaches here, he says, he who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. If we're willing to compromise on what is least, on the little things, the physical things, it will lead to compromise in the greater things, those that are spiritual. Are we faithful, as it says here, in little things, and what is least? Well, sometimes we are, and sometimes we aren't. For the remainder of this message, I'd like to dig deeper into this instruction from Jesus Christ, being faithful in little. We're not perfect in our faithfulness to God. We struggle, but we try. We try. And if we're to succeed in being faithful to the end, we must be faithful in little. The title for this message is Faithful in Little. King David is one example in Scripture of someone who was faithful in the little things. He was faithful in the little things. Now, there are also examples when he wasn't faithful in little things, and he had great blunders and mistakes that were very impactful on his life. But we find several examples of David's faithfulness in Scripture, especially early in life. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 16. The first example of David and his faithfulness, being faithful in little, is David as the shepherd. David as the shepherd. 1 Samuel chapter 16, we're going to begin reading in verse 1. First Samuel 16, verse 1, says, Now the Lord said to Samuel, How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I am sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons. And Samuel said, How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me. But the Lord said, Take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Pause there just for a moment. Samuel is one of the greatest examples of unwavering and steadfast faithfulness to God and how he served God. And here we get a glimpse into his life where he is a bit more relatable. You know, he's human. It's not a lack of faith here, but he's expressing concern. Saul is not going to appreciate this, and God provides a solution. Verse 3, continuing. God says, Then invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me the one I named you. So Samuel did what the Lord said and went to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, Do you come peaceably? And he said peaceably, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So it was when they came that he looked at Eliab and said, Surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Verse 7, But the Lord said to Samuel, Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, Neither has the Lord chosen this one. Then Jesse made Shema pass by, and he said, Neither has the Lord chosen this one. Thus Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, The Lord has not chosen these. We'll pause there. I want to draw attention here that Jesse and all of his sons were invited by Samuel to the sacrifice, but David was excluded. All the other seven, they were invited, they were presented by Jesse before to Samuel, except for David. Now, perhaps they actually thought less of David, or perhaps it's just the fact that David was excluded because of his age. He was the youngest. Maybe he wasn't considered of age yet. In either case, David wasn't considered important enough to be there. It's just David. He needs to take care of the sheep, and he's too young anyhow. Who knows what their thoughts were? But David wasn't there. He was too insignificant. Verse 11. And Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all the young men here?" Then he said, "There remains yet the youngest, and there he is, keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here." So David's situation here seems to be the exact opposite of, like, for example, Joseph, Israel's son Joseph. He was the youngest, or of the youngest, and he was kept back. He was given extra special treatment because he was the youngest. David here seems to have the opposite situation, where he's kind of brushed aside, and he's just taking care of the sheep. He's a little insignificant. That's at least how it comes across. He was sent out to take care of a lesser responsibility. So his contribution here was to watch the sheep. Now, I grew up with sheep. Not a big, huge flock like David probably was watching. Usually only around a half dozen or so. And we didn't shepherd them. We didn't have to watch them. They were fenced in a fenced-in pasture. But from my experience, sheep are not very intelligent, and they're pretty boring most of the time. But this is the job David was given to do. He was to watch the sheep. You know, let's think a little bit. What do sheep do? Well, they eat for a while, and they bleat, and they talk, and then they lie down, and they chew the cud, and then they move over there, because it's better food over there, and they eat, and they lie down, and they chew the cud. And they just do this over and over throughout the day. There's not a lot happening. But this was David's mundane task, this boring job that he was given to do. Verse 12 and verse 13, continuing. So he sent and brought him. Now he was ruddy, with bright eyes and good looking. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is the one." Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel arose and went to Ramah. So far, David did not have a lot going for him. He didn't have excitement in his life, but he was dedicated, and he did what he was asked to do, even this insignificant little task of watching the sheep. And as we move into the second point, or the second example, we see how this has even more impact, or the benefits that David gains from this experience as a shepherd boy. The second example is just one chapter over in chapter 17, and we'll call this David the delivery boy. Chapter 17, verse 12. Chapter 17, verse 12. This is within the story of David and Goliath, and he's again doing the little and seemingly insignificant things. Verse 12 of 1 Samuel, chapter 17. Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons, and the man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. Now, this is the battle of David and Goliath, the battle between Israel and the Philistines. The names of the 3 sons that went to battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. Verse 14, David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. Then Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp. And carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000, and seek how your brothers fare, and bring back news of them." And pause there. So David at this point had already been anointed king. He was to be the next king of Israel. But his life had not changed in the least. He was still the insignificant youngest son who was running errands, who was watching the sheep. You know, he left his father's sheep to deliver these goods. And he doesn't seem to complain at all. Now, maybe he volunteered for this job because he really wanted to go see what was going on. Probably. I mean, he became a great man of war later on. But in any case, He didn't seem to view his job as insignificant or complain or bellyache about it. He did it, and he did it the way he was asked. Verse 20, we'll drop down a few verses. Verse 20, so David did as he was asked. So David arose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army, and David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words, so David heard them. Verse 24, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. We'll skip a few verses, drop down to verse 33. The next verses that we're not going to read is when David encourages all the men not to be afraid, not to be afraid of Goliath because God was on their side. Verse 33. Then David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your father's servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. And we'll stop there. Now, we certainly can't overlook, David spoke boldly here, and we know what happens. He went out against Goliath, and God delivered him into his hand. And we certainly can't overlook the important fact that God determined the outcome of this battle. It was in God's hand. But it would also be inaccurate to assume that, or to overlook the fact that David had skills that helped and aided in his fight against Goliath. God didn't choose someone who had, been a studious academic all his life and had never been outside to try to do this. He used David's skills. What did David do as a shepherd? And we can kind of imagine a little bit. He's out there watching the sheep. We already talked about how it's probably pretty boring most of the time. Occasionally it got exciting when a lion or a bear came around, but most of the time it was pretty boring. What did he do to occupy his time? Well, we know he wrote music. He wrote poetry and songs. But we also know that he was quite energetic. We can see that from his life. He was probably perfecting the craft of using his sling. He was able to kill lions and bears with it. He probably picked a target and for hours and hours would shoot rocks at it to keep his mind busy, to stay busy. And then he would probably step back a little further, try to hit that same target. I guarantee you, if he was at the back of this hall with a slingshot, he would probably hit an apple off my head. He was skilled at what he did. A marksman becomes great by practicing. If you were to decide to become a hunter, to take up that hobby, to go deer hunting, and you go buy a bow or a gun, you don't go straight out into the woods and hope that you kill a deer. You go practice. David practiced. David was faithful in the little things. In those little things, he was dedicated to doing his job. He wasn't napping. He kept busy. If he was napping, the lions and the bears would have succeeded. He did what he was tasked to do, all those little things. And then here is the first example in his fight against Goliath where it paid off in a big way. It paid off in a big way. We must do the same. We must be faithful in little. The third example that we will look at in David's life is a few chapters over in 1 Samuel 25. By this point, some time has passed. He is now an adult. He's become a man. He has been successful in battle to the point where Saul hates him because he's more popular than he is. And so he is persecuted by Saul and he flees in the wilderness. And we'll pick up the story here in chapter 25, the story of David and Nabal and Abigail. We'll read beginning in verse 2. Verse 2 of 1 Samuel chapter 25. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, he sent 10 young men and said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, 'Peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask your men, your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David.'" We'll pause there. David had 400 men, we read earlier, 400 men with him, and he chose to protect the shepherds of Nabal. He's asking for generosity and favor from Nabal because of this good deed, but I don't think he did it. You know, he didn't do the good deed thinking, "Oh, I'm going to get something for this someday. I'm going to get my payment for this." No, I think he did it because it was the right thing to do. Of course, we know that Nabal insults him and his men and sends them away. But Nabal's men tell Abigail, the wise wife of Nabal, about the good things David and his men had done in even more detail. We'll read that in verses 14 through 16. You know, we know David was furious and reacts emotionally. But here, one of the men of Nabal goes to Abigail, and of course, the outcome is that David doesn't do a horrible thing. And we read here a little more detail of what David and his men did for the shepherds. Verse 14, step back here. "Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, 'Look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields.'" Verse 16, "They were a wall to us both by night and day, all the time we were with them keeping the sheep." Now, they focus on the fact that they didn't hurt us. David's men said this, Nabal's young man here said this, so it must have been pretty common for, you know, what looks like a band of robbers or a small army, David and his men, to kind of push their weight around and intimidate people and, you know, "Hey, you owe me this because I'm big and strong. We're big and strong. You need to feed us. You need to give us payment for protection." But that's not the case here. They emphasize they were a wall to us both by night and day, all the time we were with them keeping the sheep. Not only were David's men, you know, didn't hurt them, but they intentionally protected them. Why was that? Well, we don't know for sure, but I would guess that all those years that David was a shepherd influenced this. He knew what it was like to be out there all by himself with the dangers lurking about, whether it's people or whether it's lions and bears. And he could have just kept going. He and his 400 men could have gone somewhere else and been comfortable and didn't have to keep watch or didn't have to help out. But they stopped. They watched out for them. They were fleeing from Saul anyhow. They were staying away, so it worked out just fine. He could have used authority. He could have used intimidation and said, "Hey, we'll do this, but you're going to have to give us a cut of something you have here." No, he didn't do that at all. They didn't take anything from them. He did this little thing because it was the right thing to do, and it was within his power and ability to do it. So here are three examples. Three examples of David and how he was faithful in what many would consider little things. Nothing glorious, nothing that brought a lot of attention to himself. He was a shepherd, he was a delivery boy, and here he was the protector of the innocent. Fast forward 3,000 years. How does being faithful and little look in our lives? You know, none of us are shepherds. None of us are taking wagons. In this case, he took the wagon of goods 20 miles to take it to his brothers. That's like going walking from here to downtown Akron. None of us have these things in our lives, but we have other things that we very much struggle with, that we very much can show that we are faithful in little. So what areas in our lives reveal whether or not we are faithful, whether we're faithful in little? Well, the first one that came to mind for me was procrastination. That's a tough one. And we all procrastinate, right? Some of us procrastinate a lot. And some of us rarely procrastinate, but all of us do it. So what is it? What is procrastination? Well, a definition that I found on a website called solvingprocrastination.com, which was interesting. They had a lot of good stuff on there. Procrastination is unnecessarily postponing decisions or actions. That's what procrastination is. For example, a person is procrastinating if they have a week to finish an assignment, but they delay getting started until right before its deadline for no good reason. Mr. Troyer and I were talking recently, and we said, that sounds a lot like us this week. We're preparing a message, and sometimes you just put it off too long. Why do we do it? Why do we procrastinate? Well, there are a couple reasons. A lot of times we don't like the task. Maybe we find it boring or really hard, or we just don't think we're going to be good at it, but we avoid it because we don't like it. Perhaps we don't know how to do it. I had an example of that this past summer. Sometime mid to late summer, our dishwasher started leaking. And at first, you know, we have a vinyl floor, so it wasn't hurting anything on the floor or the cabinets. You put a towel down, it wasn't dripping, it was dripping a little bit. And I look into it, okay, what might it be? Well, I'll replace this seal. Order the seal on Amazon, you get it in, put the seal in, still leaking. So then you kind of give up for a little bit, procrastinate a little bit, and then you try this other thing. Eventually, if 4 months later, this thing's still leaking, still haven't fixed it, and my wife's been sopping up water in a towel for 4 months. These things happen. Eventually, we just got another dishwasher. But we avoid things because we don't know how to do it. There's this problem, and I'm not sure how to fix it, so I'm just going to keep pushing it off. That's sometimes the reason. Maybe because something's overwhelming. It's too big. You know, we avoid doing laundry for a couple days because this pile is huge now. Ah, it's going to take so long. Or cleaning up the messy garage or the messy basement because it's just such a big project now. How about anxiety for fear of failure? You know, maybe we're perfectionists and we don't like doing things wrong. We don't like failing, so we put it off because I don't think I'm going to do well at this. Maybe it's bad habits. Bad habits that kind of allow us to procrastinate. Checking our phones all the time. How about that one? Maybe it's social media or sports news. Maybe we were checking if the Browns made the playoffs or not. You know, we keep ourselves busy with things we like to do instead of doing what we should do. So procrastination is not doing something we need to do. It has nothing to do with the extracurriculars, the fun things in life, the extra things in life. The things that we need to do. And it never makes it better. You know, that garage didn't start out as a messy garage. It became a big mountain that is overwhelming over time. It never gets better. They say that it takes 1 to 2 months to form a habit, that habit that now makes it hard for us to stay on task with something. It didn't happen overnight. Let's turn to Proverbs 24. Read a section here, Proverbs 24, verses 30 through 34. It's not directly about procrastination, but the outcome is the same. Proverbs 24, verse 30 through 34. Verse 30 says, I went by the field of the lazy man, and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. And there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles. Its stone wall was broken down. When I saw it, I considered it well. I looked on it and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So shall your poverty come like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. And this is talking about laziness, and that's not the exact same thing. But as I said, the illustration is also about a lack of diligence. It deteriorates our lives like this field, overgrown with thorns and thistles. Over time, small problems become big problems. And that's why procrastination in the little things leads to unfaithfulness in big things. Something else that reveals whether or not we're faithful in little is our sins, those little sins. You know, we can all think of those examples. One example that I think of in a way that the world really looks at something as a little sin. You know, we as humans tend to rate things as how severe is this? How bad really is this? I worked with a man years ago, and he was sharing a story with me one day, and I still remember this. And at the end of whatever he was sharing, I don't remember what he was telling me, but he was justifying something. And he said, it was just a little white lie. It wasn't like it was a black lie. Not a big deal. I still chuckle when I think of it. I'd never heard something called a black lie. I still haven't heard it since. But his point was, this isn't really a big deal. It was. Yeah, I lied, but it's not a big deal. How might we do that, you know? What's not a big deal? I won't turn there, but we'll reference Song of Solomon, chapter 2, and verse 15. It says, catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. It's talking about little things, that it's not some big thing that came in and destroyed all these grapes. It's the little foxes that come in and over time nibbled away and they ruined this vineyard. What are our little sins? We'll list a few things that might be a difficulty for us. How about bending the truth for fear of getting in trouble? That's one I struggled with as a kid. I did not like getting in trouble. So you just kind of shade it a little bit so it's not quite so bad. It's still a lie. How about telling our boss that we're almost done with a project when we haven't even started? How about speeding just enough to avoid getting pulled over? Or maybe cheating on a test? Just one question. It was the only one I didn't know. Maybe embellishing on a resume or a job application. Or last one we'll list is maybe watching something on TV that's either dark and maybe gory or maybe risque. These little sins desensitize us, and they make it easier to progressively sin more and more over time. You know, you think of marital affairs and some of the other big sins people would consider big sins. They are never standalone incidents. Something always led up to that point. Something ate away at their perspective and respect for God's design of marriage. It's the obedience in the little things and avoiding the little sins that's crucial for us to be faithful in little. Let's turn next to Psalm chapter 55. One more point that we'll cover in this regard. Psalm chapter 55 and verse 16. There are many other points we could list, many other things that probably come to your mind that relate to being faithful in little. I just have this one more. Back to David, and another example of David here. Verse 16. You know, David's writing this psalm, and he's talking about his enemies, and he's talking about the results of wickedness. And then he says in verse 16, but as for me, I will call upon God, and the Lord shall save me. Evening and morning and at noon, I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. We'll pause there. Here is another example, perhaps the most important example that David provides in being faithful in little. He was in daily contact with God. Point number three, to be faithful in little, we must be in daily contact with God. You know, we know that this was so important to David. We can read so many psalms and other examples. You know, he wrote, Psalm 119 says, "Your word I have hidden in my heart that I might not sin against you." And later, "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." Being in God's word and in prayer with God daily is crucial. We know that. But it's one of those things that can slowly erode away, or we get off our routine. You know, do we only pray and study diligently when we feel like it? Or only when we're going through a trial? You know, things happen in life that can derail our routines, like having children, changing jobs, something that shakes up our routine. But we must find a way to have some contact with our Creator every day. Anytime we get away from that, we start forgetting, you know, we start forgetting how important things are in God's perspective and what His perspective is. You know, the world erodes away at us if we are not in contact with Him. You know, this is a foothold that Satan will latch onto to try to keep us from God. So hopefully these three points provide some food for thought for self-evaluation. You know, life is hard. That's a guarantee for Christians from Jesus Christ Himself. He said that life would be hard if we follow Him, but it is more than worth it. You know, we're all good at some of these little things. There are things in life that we're really good at, and other things we struggle with. What about those things we're struggling with, the things we need to improve in? Well, let's begin concluding with four quick action steps. Four quick steps to improve in being faithful in little. Point number one, first action step, set a realistic goal. Set a realistic goal. Tomorrow is the last day of 2023, and the world is busy making New Year's resolutions. It's a good concept, really. You know, improving oneself, being better at something, it's a good thing, but most people don't stick it out. Why do they fail at accomplishing their goals? Well, one reason is because their goal isn't realistic. You know, maybe it's too big of a goal or too many obstacles in the way. Not the right time frame. Maybe I'm going to do this over the course of a year. That's a big goal that's really hard to stay on top of. For example, let's say you want to exercise more. The goal of making a goal to run a mile by the end of the month is a whole lot better way to start than saying, well, I'm just going to be in good shape by the end of the year. You know, that's too vague. A realistic goal. We need to choose one goal, not 10, not 5, one goal to start. And if it's kind of a big one, break it down into smaller goals. But choose one specific goal, something realistic that we can do. We're talking about being faithful in little. And this goal doesn't even have to be something negative, like, oh, I've really been struggling with this problem. I need to overcome this. It can be something else, like a lot of people, they like to choose a word or something biblical that's their focus or their guide for the year. You know, maybe they say, okay, this year my word is courage or faithful or generous or thankful. Something that, okay, this year I'm really going to deep dive into studying this and learn how to practice it in my life better. We can have lots of goals that are not too big but very impactful. Step two, take it seriously. Take it seriously. And this is another reason people fail. You know, it becomes a pet idea, something they'd really like to do if they had all the time in the world and effort to put into it. But when it really gets hard, they're like, I didn't really want to do that. And we need to take it seriously. And we can pray for God to help us with that, to give us the motivation and the desire to do it. Step number three, make a plan for accountability. Make a plan for accountability. This is where I often fall short. We need a partner or someone that is willing to actually hold us accountable, someone that we trust, someone that, you know, we don't feel like will be, slapped upside the head, but they will make sure that they remind us when we're falling short. You know, another thing in this plan of accountability is to identify the things we'll struggle with. You know, what habits or what distractions are going to get in the way from our past experience, and make a plan for how to either remove those distractions from our environment or what steps to take to make sure we don't fall into that bad habit again. Like, for example, if eating healthier is our goal, we probably shouldn't have a bunch of candy bars and, you know, sugary treats in our house. That wouldn't be conducive to succeeding. Step number four, last step, choose motivating rewards. This is another one that I think we can overlook sometimes because you feel like, well, I don't deserve this, or, you know, but we as people, we thrive off of being rewarded. We thrive off of being rewarded. So if we stick with our example of eating healthier, perhaps every Sabbath we give ourselves a break. On Sabbath, I get to have a treat. I get to have this thing I enjoy. I was eating healthy all week, and if you accomplish that goal, you treat yourself, you reward yourself. But we need motivation. If you think of any of the amazing stories that we've read of people overcoming great odds, all of them had something that motivated them. They all had that. If they hadn't, they would have given up. They would have lost heart. And God knows this about us. Jesus Christ promised that those who follow him will receive 100-fold now in this time and in the age to come. A promise for those who follow God. So let's wrap this up. Having faith and being faithful, they go hand in hand. They're inseparable. Sometimes we can maybe think that, you know, faith is this and faithfulness, you know, it's different. No, they're really the same thing in so many ways. We know that having faith is believing that something is true, something we can't see, but we trust, we believe. And being faithful is the actions that follow that up, that show that someone's reliable, someone is trustworthy. Brethren, we have faith. All of us have faith. We're here each Sabbath. We have faith in God because he is faithful to his promises. We have seen that he is faithful to his promises in the past, and we believe he is going to be faithful to promises that will be fulfilled in the future without fail. And we show that our faith, we show our faith by being faithful in little things. Let's read one more scripture to conclude. One more verse, Matthew chapter 25. A parallel passage to what we read in the introduction in Luke chapter 16. Matthew 25, we'll read verse 20. Something we all want to hear. This is within the parable of the talents, and we know this very well. Each servant was given talents and expected to do something with it. Verse 20 of Matthew chapter 25, Matthew 25, verse 20, it says, I wrote down the wrong verse. Let me find what I'm looking for just a moment. Verse 23, Matthew 25, verse 23. And his Lord said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord." Very encouraging for us. Importance of being faithful in little. Brethren, we've all chosen to forsake this world and its ways and its pleasures to follow Jesus Christ. And he promises that he will reward us. Let's all choose a goal for ourselves that will help us do even better at being faithful in little. And we will receive 100-fold now in this time and in the age to come.